This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are talking Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, chapters 21 and 22, The Eye of the Snake and St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries. In these chapters, basically everything between November and the end of term.
Everything happens.
Like Hagrid's inspection, crazy dreams, hospital visit, going to Grimmauld Place, many things.
Many things happen in a very interesting way. The way this is told is very unique, I thought,
for these books.
I think maybe the snake sequence, you know, it's a dream, but I don't know, something about the tone just kind of shifted in the end of that chapter. So.
So overall, how did you feel about these chapters?
You know, the thing that I appreciate about the series is there are things that I don't even think need explanation that get explanation, like a wizard hospital. I was like, never thought about that. Now, why didn't I think about that? There's a medical ward at Hogwarts, but kind of the complexities of the hospital and what would necessitate hospitalization. Pretty interesting. And then I don't know what is going on with Harry, but I'm sure we'll figure it out eventually.
Of course. And so we begin with chapter 21, The Eye of the Snake. And it starts with Hermione plowed her way back to Hagrid's cabin through 2 feet of snow on Sunday morning. So we already know from previous chapter that Hermione is like, I'll plan his lessons myself, like, you know, to protect Hagrid from like Umbridge's, you know, implicit bias. And so the boys don't go with her because they've got so much homework because they're not being on top of that shit.
Yeah, right.
And Ron is just like, you know, getting distracted by people having fun outside with snowballs. And he's like, oi, I'm a prefect. And if one more snowball hits this window, and of course, it's Fred and George.
Of course.
I've gotten a snowball in the face.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yeah, it was sophomore year, winter term, like about to be the end. And I was writing a paper and there were these drunk people and I'm like, be quiet, I'm working. And then, snowball in the face.
Well, my cold story, I like bit it in front of like an entire, like classes were letting out and I like slid down this hill because there was ice out. So didn't get pegged in the face with a snowball. And then I flipped some guy off because he made fun of me. So,
Yep. And Hermione comes back. So, said Ron, got all his lessons planned for him? Well, I tried, she said, sinking into a chair besides Harry. I never really paid much attention to this. She basically uses her wand as a hairdryer.
Oh, cute. Yes.
To, like, dry out her clothes.
That's cute. Yeah. She's clever.
So he wasn't even there for the first half hour, and then he came, like, trotting out of the Forbidden Forest. And, you know, he won't tell them what he's showing them for his lesson. He says he wants there to be a surprise. I try to explain about Umbridge, but he just doesn't get it. He keeps saying no one in their right mind would rather study gnarls than And then a chimera. Oh, I don't think he's got a chimera, she added at the appalled looks on Harry and Ron's face. Which a chimera, isn't it that like three-headed, like lion's head, dragon's head, like this tail is a snake or some crazy shit in mythology? I forget.
Oh my gosh. Now that you say that, I thought it was just like a Harry Potter word at first, but then I'm like, now that you say that, I'm just typing very quickly into... This looks like a fish, so I don't know. I have no idea what it is, but
okay. Or maybe I'm confusing it with a manticore in mythology. I don't know.
I don't either.
Anyway, so basically all of Hermione's efforts to protect Hagrid from Umbridge have fallen flat.
I mean, Umbridge is like, she's going to get her little grubby paws in humiliation of whatever teacher she's into, no matter what. But good on Hermione for like trying. I thought it was, you know, like it's just so interesting that she's like, yeah, I'm absolutely going to write these lesson plans for him, and she does. So good for her.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. It was a certain amount of apprehension that Harry, Ron, and Hermione headed down to Hagrid's on Tuesday, heavily muffled against the cold. So Harry was worried not only about what Hagrid might have decided to teach them, but also about how the rest of the class, particularly Malfoy and his cronies, would behave if Umbridge was watching them.
Freaking Malfoy and the crew, yep. Always.
And Hagrid is like, we'll be working in the forest, you know, a bit more sheltered. Anyway, they prefer the dark. And Malfoy's like, what prefers the dark?
Yeah, he freaks out because he's... A weenie, but also the like
chicken shit.
Yeah, but good. Like, I liked that they made him nervous. And this is also pretty interesting because they don't, you know, it was stay out of the forest. Of course, Harry's not going to stay out of the forest. Eventually he went there, but you know, this is kind of like, I guess this is again, progressing forward in their years at Hogwarts. They're like, yeah, Hagrid's saying we're going to the forest. This is intentional. Let's go check it out.
Yeah, because we haven't been to the forest substantially since book two with spiders.
Yeah.
Or I think Prisoner of Azkaban, there's nothing in the forest. It's all about the Shrieking Shack. Goblet of Fire, they're just at the edge of the forest with Victor Crumb. Okay. So yeah, like nothing, not a lot of forest escapades. You know, this is the first one in a while.
Yeah, which was good to have that old Forbidden Forest back.
Yep. And so they're trudging along and they walked and so Hagrid turned, shook his shaggy head and gave an odd shrieking cry that echoed through the dark trees like the call of some monstrous bird. I honestly imagined Hagrid like making a sort of peacock sound.
Oh, really? I was thinking my dad used to elk hunt and he would have like an elk call, and it's very different, but I don't even know how to do it. But
which is just funny with the peacock call because, you know, I went out for like happy hour with some, you know, colleagues and coworkers, and, you know, we were, many of them were like Chinese and Taiwanese. And so we were like talking about like onomatopoeic words, like what's the word for like the noise for certain animals.
Oh, okay.
And so that also got into like imitation of animals. And so everyone was laughing at my chicken and turkey impressions. And then I'm like, and then there's a peacock and she's like, what's the peacock sound like? And I'm like, well, wait for the waitress to go. I don't want her to think I'm a freak.
I don't even know what a peacock sounds like. I'm like, now we know.
And now my cats are like, what the fuck, Amy?
Aww,
and geez. Cupcake's going back to sleep.
Oh, Cupcake. Yep.
So, and we finally, Harry gets some validation because what is Hagrid showing them?
Spooky horses. I know that's not their name.
Yeah, the spooky horses. So yeah. Harry's like, Hagrid knows about them. I'm not insane.
Thestral? Is that how you say the name?
Yes, Thestral. So, and... there's only a handful of students that can see these thestrals. Harry can, Neville can, and right. Some random ass Slytherin that we don't care about.
And then I think it's also like Luna can. So
Luna
she's
can, already, but she's not in this specific class.
she's not in the class, but it made me think like, oh, okay, so, you know, the only people that can see the Thestrals are the people that have experienced, the only people who can see Thestrals are people who have seen death. So what we kind of know what Neville has seen. We know what Harry has seen. I don't know what Luna has seen. So I think that was just raised an interesting question. What is that kinship that she and Harry share that we hopefully will learn about maybe? I don't know.
Yep. And on, you know, everyone else, it literally just looks like that the carcass is like stripping itself off the bone and it's just the meat's just disappearing into thin air.
Pretty creepy. I also want to just call out Hagrid for a second, okay?
Yeah,
what about? He's telling them like, oh, you'll find out, you'll find out. Not that it's like an embarrassment to experience death. I mean, obviously, you know, to see somebody die. Everybody knows about Harry because it's a famous story. And then also, you know, he's had that encounter. But there are some kids like maybe they don't want to really talk about it. Like Neville very much kind of backs down. He's like, oh, it was my grandma or my grandfather, grandmother. He doesn't talk about, you know, anybody else. But his parents died because they went insane. Is that right? Or am I misremembering?
No, his parents are alive.
Oh, okay. They're
so
just...
It was a different relative that he saw, like, pass away, you know, from old age, I think.
Okay. So he doesn't really want to talk about it.
Yeah, it's not a highlight that probably Neville has any desire to talk about.
Right. So I kind of think, like, Hagrid, it's a little... Like, sure, it's a really... interesting creature, but it's also kind of like a little insensitive to do that to this class.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not gonna disagree with you.
Oh, okay. I was like, oh my gosh, what did I not know?
No, but, it's not this something. No, I just wasn't thinking about it that way. I don't know. I guess, you know, these kids are an age where like, it would make sense that maybe some students like would have like grandparents or maybe, you know, some other experience that would cause this. But yeah, it can be interpreted as being a little insensitive. And before Hagrid can get any farther, we get Professor Umbridge.
Of course.
And so what did you think of, you know, Umbridge's inspection of Hagrid?
So there's an exercise, if anybody's in therapy, that you do sometimes. Like if somebody says you're sensitive, you know, you could also take that to mean you are a good listener. And that's a bad example. But, you know, you could say something negative that some other people would interpret it as a positive. And I was thinking about Dolores where, you know, Hagrid is kind of like, she thinks he's slow. Like he's kind of like just trying to teach. I don't know what this lady's issue is, but everything he's doing to kind of like help, you know, help people understand, she's like, oh man, this guy is an idiot. What does he say? Has to resort to crude sign language. You know, when in actuality, he's like, I'm trying to tell you, you know, maybe you're not understanding me. So it's almost this like this thing that drives me crazy in movies, the like misunderstanding between characters, like when you, the audience member or somebody knows, or books or something, when you have that knowledge and the two characters don't have the knowledge. She's just, I mean, in at the very basic level without all that, she's just being herself. She's not being a nice person. She's not a nice person. So she's just being a kind of a jerk. Like, do we expect anything different, though? No.
No, we do not. And this particularly has to resort to crude sign language, basically implying that Hagrid does not speak English adequately. So yeah. This reminded me of an instance at the University of Oklahoma, my husband's home state. So we were in Oklahoma. My husband had some little administrative thing he needed to do at the financial aid office. And there was this one blonde older woman who was saying, oh, you need to like send this to like Indiana University, you know, where we are now. And he's like, which part, like what? And she started going deliberately slower to Indiana University. And I was this close and I was with him. I was this close to saying like, ma'am, you're not being clear. You are not telling my husband which department of IU, he needs to get this paperwork too. I don't even understand it. Like, do not insult his ability to speak English. And that's what I wanted to say, but I restrained myself because, again, I didn't, like, my husband had to get whatever thing done and didn't want to piss her off that she didn't do it.
Right. That's annoying. It's not very nice. I mean, at the very basic, and it's just like Hagrid. I can't stand Dolores Umbridge. She's horrible.
Yeah.
Shows signs of pleasure at the idea of violence. Basically, she's taking everything that he's doing and flipping it, you know, like making it worse.
Yeah. And then she starts going around talking to the students. And of course, the Slytherins, Malfoy and Pansy capitalize on this completely.
Yeah, of course.
And even like, you know, take advantage of Neville's just general nervousness on general principles, saying students are too intimidated to admit they are frightened.
Right. That,
yeah.
I don't know. The lack of emotional intelligence in this situation for Neville. I mean, we don't expect anything.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, confirmation bias.
Right. Right.
You see what you want to see a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she leaves. And Hermione is like really, really pissed off because she's like, you know, for Hagrid, Thestrals are actually really, really good and tame.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the
sad part.
Right. That is very true. But and then, you know, she kind of has a little bit of a misstep where she's like, I wish I could see him. And Harry's like, do you? She's like, oh, whoops. Shouldn't have said that.
She's like, well, it's like Hagrid said, they can look after themselves, said Hermione. And I suppose a teacher like Grubbly Plank wouldn't usually show them to us before any WT level. But, well, they are very interesting, aren't they? The way some people can and some can't, I wish I could. Do you? Said Harry asked her quietly. Yeah, Hermione putting her foot in her mouth.
Yeah, and I kind of, like, I read that twice because my first kind of interpretation of how Harry said that was kind of somber, you know, and then the next time I was like, oh, maybe he meant it more like a little, you know, come on, Hermione, let's think about what we're talking about.
Yeah. And Draco being a dick. Weasley, we were just wondering, do you reckon if you saw someone snuff it, you'd be able to see the quaffle better?
Oh my God, he thinks he's so funny with that too. You just know it.
Like, which I will admit that one is a little more original than it's just, oh, you're poor.
That is a little, yes, it
was is a little it is a teeny bit more creative.
We're getting more mature in our jabs toward the Weasleys, I guess. So.
Yep. So December arrives and, you know, Ron and Hermione get bombarded with prefect duties like decorating the castle. And, you know, Hermione wants to start knitting more hats, and she's like, all those poor elves, I haven't set free yet, having to stay over during Christmas because there aren't enough hats. Harry, who had not had the heart to tell her that Dobby was taking everything she made, bent lower over his History of Magic essay, which, honestly, you know, I would be like, Hermione, Dobby's taking them all. Yeah. And I would in some way convey you're insulting them, and now Dobby is doing everything.
Yeah, it's one of those situations. It's like, let's say somebody teaches yoga with puppies, and somebody was like, actually, this is like a really horrible idea, and the dogs hate it. Maybe they would stop. I would rather know instead of continuing to do this thing where my heart is in the right place, or I think I have good intentions, but in actuality, you know, she's just making one more work for somebody she probably would definitely not want to do that for.
Yeah. So, yeah. So we've got Harry's, you know, busy with, you know, the DA meetings, you know, what has he got? Between his Quidditch ban and worry about whether or not Hagrid was going to be put on probation, he felt highly resentful towards the place at the moment, the place being Hogwarts. And because this is the first time he's kind of felt this way, like he's gone through other sort of like bad stints in his celebrity, like with Chamber of Secrets, right, and Goblet of Fire, but not to this degree. Because it was just, yeah, at least at that point, it was more the students. And now we've got this High Inquisitor with the power of, you know, power of the ministry trying to pick a fight with a 15-year-old, and it's gross.
And, like, very absent Dumbledore. Like, Dumbledore usually doesn't make a big appearance until the end of the, you know, the books, but very much kind of very strange relationship with Dumbledore right now.
Yeah, so the only thing he really looks forward to is the DA meetings. And so he was thinking he was, he was going to have to stay while Ron was going home to the Burrow. And he's like, but of course you're coming. Didn't I say Mom wrote and told me to invite you weeks ago? And so I'm just thinking, why wouldn't Harry just on his own be like, he could talk to McGonagall and just be like, I want to stay with Sirius over Christmas. Why was that not an option?
That's a good question. Also, why the hell didn't Ron tell him that he was going to go stay at the Burrow? There's a lot of weird things going on here.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, why? Like, again, partially with Dumbledore being so icy, like, Harry's at a point, you know, and he has this, like, pride thing going on with Umbridge, like, the way he did say anything about, like, how she was cutting up his hand with the blood quill. He's just at a point, you know, he's just at a point that he's not wanting to ask anything of anyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, my husband sometimes can get into that mindset because you don't want to be beholden to anyone that you don't 100% trust, like, has your, you know, back and stuff. And, you know, Ian sometimes has tried to push that on to me and my own family. And I'm like, you know, no, like, my dynamic with this person is totally different from your dynamic with whatever person. You know, we can informally, you know, ask and do things for each other.
I wonder if that's a Cancerian trait, because I have a really hard time asking people to do anything for me. I don't know. So. Yeah,
well, but Harry's a Leo and he's doing this.
Well, then Harry is a defeated Leo, because Leos are like, that is funny. Anyway, sorry, I will not, we can talk about astrology later. But well, we have some more romance here with Miss Cho Chang.
Yes, we've got the last DA meeting and Harry has to scramble to get rid of Dobby's decorations because he took it upon himself to, like, decorate the DA room in all these baubles with Harry's face on it that said, "Have a very Harry Christmas."
Oh my goodness.
He's like the president of the HP fan club.
Yeah, he really is. He needs to chill. I would be so embarrassed. I don't know if Harry is. Maybe the Leo in him is pretty psyched about it.
He gets rid of everything. And the first one walks in is Luna. And she's like, you know, these are nice. Did you put them up? No, it was Dobby the house elf. Mistletoe, said Luna dreamily, pointing at a large clump. And Harry immediately jumps out of it. And she's like, good thinking, said Luna very seriously. It often infested with nargles. And so I'm just wondering, you know, with Luna's, like, dreaminess, I sometimes wonder, is she just playing dumb? And she, you know, and then she's just, you know, sometimes she calls people out, but sometimes maybe she doesn't. Or, like, it's interesting to think, like, I don't know, like, I just took the reading that, you know, that Luna, for as spacey as she is, she's not dumb.
I get the impression, like, she knows exactly what she's doing, but she has the kind of, I saw something on TikTok called, like, bimbofication, which I'm fascinated with, which is basically, like, pretending you're stupid because of how people treat you. I don't think she's necessarily falling into the bimbofication, but I also think that there's a little bit of her. She definitely, I think she knows more than she lets on. I think she's also a bit of a flirt. Like, man, she's in, you know, saving a little bit of face here, but she's kind of put some feelers out for Harry, put some feelers out for Ron. And, you know, because I don't know. I like her. I think she's fun.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just interesting to think about, you know, what exactly is going on in her head.
Yeah. I want to know.
Yep. And so we've got the last lesson of, you know, that they're just reviewing everything and Zachariah Smith is still being a jackass.
Good old Zachariah. Jackass Zachariah.
Yeah. Or what is the word? He's been a jerkwad.
A jerkwad. Yeah. That's, jackleg.
Have you seen the new movie Turning Red?
I haven't yet, but I've heard good things.
So one of the characters is like, Tyler is an insecure jerkwad. And it's like, jerkwad, I haven't heard that that insult in a long time.
It's a good one. It's good.
Yeah. So
clean too.
Go watch Turning Red. It's absolutely adorable for us who grew up in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I've heard good things. I've heard good things. I just have to watch it.
And actually talk about periods.
Okay, that's what I had heard too. I guess my mom tried to watch it with my 4-year-old niece and she was like, I don't know.
But it'll go over their head. But anyway, So Harry's got them all in pairs practicing, and then everyone is, you know, by the time everyone leaves, it's just Cho that's left, and, you know, Hermione gets it and immediately is like, come on, Ron, let's go.
Yeah. Cho's also having like a bit of a moment, like, which it's kind of surprising she's held it together this long.
Yeah. So Harry approaches her and he realizes that she's crying.
I'm surprised he didn't run the opposite direction, because a lot of people men might do that sometimes.
Yeah. I remember reading an article that there's literally some sort of like chemical or neurological like reaction that when men see women's tears.
Really?
Yeah, like literally to the sense like they will do like they'll do like anything to get it to stop.
Wow. Well, good to know. No, I'm a Cancer. I cry all the time since I'm not going to talk about astrology anymore.
So Cho is crying because she's like, I suppose it's just learning all this stuff. It just makes me wonder if he'd known it all, he'd still be alive.
Your heart kind of really breaks for her in that moment because he could have known everything. I mean, shoot. You know, and he still
would have been toast. And he knew a lot of stuff. He was the original actually chosen champion of Hogwarts. So he knew this shit probably better than any other student in the school.
Right. It just, I mean, and thankfully Harry kind of reassures her that like, no, what does he say? If Voldemort really wants to kill you, you don't stand a chance, which is kind of a funny thing coming out of his mouth because, as she says, you survived when you were just a baby.
Like, and not just when, and not just a baby. Like, he has, like, not that he hasn't had help, you know, but yeah. You know, he has been able to use Voldemort's hubris to his own advantage.
Right. Right.
And Cho's like, I know this must be horrible for you, me mentioning Cedric when you saw him die. I suppose you just want to forget about it. Harry did not say anything to this. It was quite true, but he felt heartless saying it. It's just a very sad situation, and just the dynamic they find themselves in, that Hermione breaks down for the two, you know, so that the dumb boys can understand.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, it's like, I really like you, Harry. And so basically we don't get anything.
Of course not. What do they call this in romance? Behind closed doors. I think BCD or something. Behind.
Okay. I didn't know there was an
like, I think it is what the trope is, but I think this is also not, I mean, they're not like, they're just kissing.
Yeah. What say. Yeah. Again, and this ain't Court of Thorns and Roses.
Damn. No, that's fine. Like, if anything, I don't want to read about that. These kids are way too young. Anyway, yes.
And so Harry's just, you know, comes back to Gryffindor Tower and is just not talking. And Hermione's just so like, is it Cho? Did she corner you after the meeting?
Yeah, Hermione's knows what's up.
Yeah. And she's like, what did she want? Ron asked. Did you kiss? Asked Hermione briskly. Like, she's just all business.
That would be me. I'd be like, come on, tell me all about it.
Yeah. And, you know, Harry finally nods and Ron is laughing. And it's like, how was it wet? Because she was crying. Oh, said Ron, his smile fading slightly. Are you that bad at kissing? Don't know, said Harry. Maybe I am. Of course you're not, said Hermione absently. And Ron is immediately like, how do you know?
come on, Ron.
So we're starting to see this, you know, budding, you know, in Goblet of Fire. You know, Ron was pissed off that obviously that Hermione went with Crumb, yeah. And you know that Hermione dares to have like a dating life and a social life outside of her being the brainchild that keeps them alive of the Golden Trio,
right?
But I think this is the first time where Ron is worried that maybe Harry could be competition.
Interesting.
For Hermione. I maybe we can interpret like other things within other books. I just feel like Goblet of Fire was the first of even acknowledging that I get pissed off if Hermione gives any other guy's attention except, yeah. You know, me. And now we're honing in on, could Harry potentially be a rival?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, that's very interesting. And you don't, you know, like you don't want to see discord between the three of them. Cause it's just kind of like sad when that happens. So you hope I hope we're not venturing. And I don't know into Harry, Ron, Hermione love triangle. Like I'm not here for that.
Yeah. No. So yeah, there is something to be said that Hermione, that name comes from the Shakespeare play, The Winter's Tale. And the whole thing about The Winter's Tale is the, you know, king thinking queen Hermione is having an affair with like his friend.
Ooh, I didn't know that. That's
yeah.
Exciting.
So there is some literary allusion to that. Anyway, so Hermione finally like stops, you know, writing her letter and she's like, okay, let me explain this to you morons.
Good for Hermione.
And, you know, obviously we're all, I assume most listeners have the emotional capacity far greater than Teaspoon. So we don't need to break this all down because it's pretty straightforward to anyone with a modicum of emotional intelligence.
Right.
You know, and, you know, it's like one person can't feel all that at once, they'd explode. Just because you've got the emotional range of a teaspoon doesn't mean we all have, said Hermione nastily.
Dang, she's like shutting these gentlemen down.
Yeah. And finally Ron is like, you know, who are you writing the novel to? Like, why, like her scroll is like going past the, you know, hanging off the desk. And she's like, Victor. Crumb? How many other Victors do we know? Ron said nothing but looked disgruntled.
Oh, yeah. And he's like, what's the deal with him? It's like, dude, you were obsessed with him. Like, goodness.
Yeah. Oh, and right before that, you know, Hermione's like, you know, oh, well, said Hermione, you know, you'll have plenty of times to ask Cho out. What if he doesn't want to ask her, said Ron, who had been watching Harry with an unusually shrewd expression on his face.
Do you think Ron is still in the, like, I'm just pretending I don't like girls still phase, or I just kind of didn't really understand?
Well, not so much him. I think it's the now being confronted with evidence that Harry is starting to engage in romantic behavior. And knowing already that Hermione has engaged in this behavior with Crumb, being like, what if he doesn't want to ask? Well, maybe like Cho is just practice and Harry really wants Hermione. Oh my God, what am I going to do?
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, I got you. Okay. So, wow. Man, I guess, you know, that does track for Ron. He's very insecure in his like things.
Yep. And so they don't say anything for 20 minutes after, you know, he knows who Hermione's writing to, and Hermione's like, nighty night. And Ron is like, what does she see in Crumb as he and Harry climbed the boy stairs? Well, said Harry, I suppose he's older, isn't he? And he's an international Quidditch player. Yeah, but apart from that, said Ron, sounding aggravated, I mean, he's a grouchy git, isn't he? A bit grouchy, yeah, said Harry.
Nobody
apparently still on Cho.
They don't know about Mr. Rochester, apparently.
And they don't know how that is the ultimate, you know, tall, dark, and handsome archetype for women.
Yeah.
And throw in the fact that he speaks with a sexy Slavic accent.
Yeah. I mean, like, come on, Ron. Get it together.
And yeah, again, I like to think that Hermione was writing that letter in Bulgarian or Russian.
Oh, that would be very cute. Very sweet. That'd
be badass. Alrighty then. And so Harry is, you know, drifts off to sleep. And at first he has this crazy ass dream where Cho is like, you know, you promised me 150 chocolate frog cards. Cedric gave me so many. And it's like, you did promise her, you know, Harry. You think you'd better give her something else instead? How about your firebolt? And then, so yeah, just total teen angsty, crazy.
I mean, I still have those dreams and I'm an old lady. So like, it's wild. It's just, yeah.
I have a reoccurring dream that like somehow I'm like redoing a semester of high school. And it's like, and I'm thinking, why am I here? I have a bachelor's. I have a master's. I don't understand why, quote unquote, I need to be doing this.
I don't, I bet a dream interpreter, you know what? Trelawney could help you figure that out if we were in that world, but yes.
And then everything fades away. His body felt smooth, powerful, and flexible. He was gliding in between shining metal bars across dark, cold stone. You know, he put out his tongue. He tasted the man's scent on the air. So, how did you think of going from this total tween whatever to this shit?
I mean, like, to the credit, to Harry's credit, like, this is how dreams usually go. Like, they just start kind of, like, weird, and then sometimes they get kind of dark. If you are riddled with anxiety like me, you have a lot of these crazy, dark dreams that are very jarring. But this is a little, I don't know how to describe how I felt about this, because, like I said, it was bizarre, because it's a dream that turns into, like, maybe a bit of seeing. Like, you know, he's kind of becomes a seer, and he becomes like a snake, basically. I mean, you know, it's still so in flux and I still don't understand it, so I'm not going to try to guess now. And for the 100 millionth time, I have not read these books to this point, so I have no idea what was going on. It was just very strange. But I do think it was a very good, like, a kind of assessment of how dreams happen. You know, they start kind of whatever, and then they just kind of go weird. And I hope I don't have a similar dream, and then somebody's bitten by a snake, like that was me, or the mental gymnastics. I don't know.
Yes. So Harry is basically envisioning himself as a snake. There's a man sleeping, and the snake just starts biting, like striking, and the man is bleeding on the floor by the time Harry wakes up.
Yes. And so Harry knows that this man is Arthur Weasley. How he comes to that conclusion, I don't know. And I read this a little more than once to kind of be like, what did I miss?
Mm-hmm. And so Harry's thrashing about, finally wakes up, and he's like, your dad's been attacked.
What the hell?
What did you think when you realized that it was Arthur Weasley who had been attacked?
I kept thinking, like, how did I miss it? Like, what did I not read? Because that's the thing that I want to do, is like, sometimes you're reading and then I'm just like, oh, I must have skipped a sentence. And then I'm like, no. It's not too surprising that it's Arthur Weasley, but it's also kind of like, where is this going?
Mm-hmm. So Harry's like still freaking out, and finally they get McGonagall to come.
Yes.
And he's like, it's Ron's dad. He's been attacked by a snake and it's serious. I saw it happen. What do you mean you saw it happen? Said Professor McGonagall. I was asleep. You mean you dreamt this? No, I was having a dream at first, and something completely different, something stupid, and then this interrupted it. It was real. I didn't imagine it. Mr. Weasley was asleep on the floor, and he was attacked by a gigantic snake. There was a lot of blood. He collapsed. Someone's got to find out where he is. And, you know, as we know from, like, the bits of the future chapter, McGonagall can realize that this is legit because she probably knew who was on guard duty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. She's got the knowledge.
Yeah. She's like, I believe you, Potter, said Professor McGonagall curtly. Put on your dressing gown. We're going straight to the headmaster.
So we get to see Dumbledore.
Mm. Yeah. And then we've got, yeah, not as enthused.
No.
Alert the media.
I know.
Jess
is
not enthused about Dumbledore.
Well, he's acting weird. I don't love it. So. Yeah.
Chapter 22 now, St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries. Again, both of these, the titles of these chapters only cover just one piece of these very jam-packed chapters. Like, so much shit happens.
Yeah.
So, Harry was so relieved that she was taking him seriously that he did not hesitate. He just got out of bed, pulled his dressing gown, and pushed his glasses back onto his nose. And so they trot on up to Dumbledore's office. And, oh, it's you, Professor McGonagall. And,
this is, like, the most stressful interaction between Harry and Dumbledore that I've read thus far.
Yeah, so how did you feel about how Dumbledore was going about this?
He's very cold to Harry. And I still don't know. And, I mean, I think as readers, we're not supposed to know why yet, but he, or maybe I just haven't figured it out. I don't know, but it's uncomfortable. Like at least it was to read, because you know Harry is just like, okay. Sometimes you come into Dumbledore's office and he's like, you know, he's giving these, you know, very memorable quotes, and he's showing you the remember all or whatever, not the remember all.
And he's giving you life lessons.
Right, right. And he's, you know, Fox is blown up and stuff. Like all kinds of things are happening. But this is like an interaction with somebody that you, it feels like they don't like you. So they're just trying to engage with you as little as possible, which is such an about face, I think, for the Dumbledore-Harry relationship. So that's why I didn't like it. It was very uncomfortable.
Yeah, so... But Dumbledore listens, even though he won't even look Harry in the eye. Mm-hmm. And upon receiving this information, he calls to the portraits in the room. And so... And asks them, like, go spread, you know, find him. Like, you know, sound the alarm. And in essence, you know, Everard and Dillis were two of Hogwarts' most celebrated heads. Their renown is such that both have portraits hanging in other important wizarding institutions. As they are free to move between their own portraits, they can tell us what may have be happening elsewhere. So we infer from that is these two, particularly, they've got portraits in the Ministry of Magic.
Yeah, yeah.
So they can go look.
That's a wild thing to think about.
So. Yeah, so it, yeah, so like normally, like within Hogwarts, you know, the, you know, people in the paintings are just hopping, you know, next door to each other. But right. We have this new thing that if it's their specific portrait, they can like transcend those sort of physical boundaries and go somewhere else entirely.
It's kind of, I mean, that's not kind of cool. It's very cool. That's pretty awesome.
Yep. And then he says to Fox, we will need a warning.
Good to see Fox again.
Yeah, Fox is awesome with his, you know, he snapped. So I just remember apparently there was, you know, in behind the scenes with Daniel Radcliffe, you know, because the first Dumbledore was played by Richard Harris for the first two films before he passed away. And okay. So when Fox was first introduced in movie two, you know, they had the animatronic bird and Richard Harris, the actor who's like an old man, saying, oh, they have these, you know, Daniel Radcliffe was saying like, oh, I was doing the scene with him and he said, oh, they've got these animals so well trained. So like people just didn't tell him that the bird was animatronic. Like oh my gosh. he thought it was an actual bird.
Wow. I mean, because he was like a baby when those things came out. That's pretty funny. Oh my goodness.
Oh, Cupcake is making cute little... Mm.
I heard a little chirp back then.
Yeah, I heard a little chirp. Oh, he loves being close to mommy. She's a good girl, even Aww. If she destroys everything. Did you hear that chirp?
Yes, that's cute. That's...
Yeah. Well, she's not delicate like Bacon was. Bacon was like, you know, a ninja.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Slowly mm-hmm. making sure he didn't knock over anything, but she's just like...
Yeah, explosion. It's funny how they can be like so different with those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but Cupcake's cuteness aside. so Dumbledore takes out this funky like silver instrument. So what did you think of this?
I'm trying to remember what the heck this was. Sorry. It was like a pipe or something. I don't know. Like, I think I was so distracted by, oh, yes, the two snakes and whatever. But I really was invested on, like, are you just freaking talk to Harry? That's what I kept thinking. So
naturally, naturally, murmured Dumbledore, apparently to himself, still observing the stream of smoke without the slightest sign of surprise, but in essence divided.
What?
So ultimately, the portraits come back, and it's like, I yelled until someone came running. They found him. They're taking him to St. Mungo's. He's bleeding pretty badly.
So Harry was right, which I'm sure he feels a little crazy. You know, like, he knows what he saw, but then getting people to believe him
and then even though you know something is true, like, getting the confirmation externally, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like, oh, shit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Dumbledore's like, Minerva, go wake up the other Weasley children. And then Molly, that'll be Fox can tell Molly what's going on. And then Phineas, there's this one jackass in a portrait, which Phineas is the great, great, great grandfather of Sirius Black.
And Phineas is kind of like, I'm not in the mood.
I'm not in the mood. I don't feel like it. But, you know, like the others had portraits in the ministry, Phineas has got a portrait in number 12 Grimmauld Place.
Right.
And tells Sirius that, you know, that bunch of guests are going to come.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I don't know if the full implication is kind of like known to maybe a first time reader. But Dumbledore, like, creating a portkey, that's, like, super illegal.
Okay. I was going to say the last portkey was in the maze, right? That's the last thing.
Like, you know, it's, you know, you need certain authorization to create a portkey. And even Mad-Eye Moody in transporting Harry early beginning of this book, they were not willing to risk, you know, discovery of creating an illegal portkey.
Right.
But Dumbledore's just like, I'm doing whatever the fuck I want.
Well, and this is a pretty big risk, I guess, then, too, for Dumbledore, because he's already on thin ice with the ministry, so.
Well, he's already on thin ice, and I think there's also the sense that there's so much magic and protection that no one's gonna, you know, detect that, oh, look, you know, red alert, Dumbledore made a portkey in his office, you know, but.
Right, yeah.
So he creates a portkey, and he, and then what is it got? And it's like, Harry, what's going on? Said Ginny, who looked frightened. And then Dumbledore finally says, your father has been injured in the course of his work for the Order of the Phoenix. So that's the first time acknowledging that, you know, Arthur was doing some shady shit for the Order. And, like, he wasn't in a place that he typically would be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And so, and then we get there was a flash of flame in the middle of the office, leaving behind a single golden feather that floated to the floor. It is Fox's warning. You know, Umbridge must know you're out of your beds. Minerva, go head her off. Tell her any story.
Yeah.
Which I'm just thinking, how would Umbridge know?
That's a good question. That she's well, this is the second time she's been kind of in a place that we're like, what the hell's the deal? You know, she was in the fire, like reaching for...
Yeah, like, Sirius. Is she also a bug and a bug like Rita Skeeter or what?
Oh my god, I forgot about that. Maybe. I don't know. They talk about her looking like a toad. Maybe she's frogging around all the time.
Popping or frogging?
Like, I'm going to call it frogging around. Okay. Like, new thing for everybody to... I don't know, man. She's a menace. We know that, but...
Yeah. So, and she's so up in, like, the Weasleys and everyone's business that... She knows if they're, like, out of bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, ugh, gross. She's gross. Again, it's just gross that Umbridge is waging war on, like, teenagers in this way.
She and, you know, good old Snape Fudge. Should hook up.
Oh, hook up.
Because he's always beating up on kids verbally or whatever.
And so they all reach for the portkey. And Harry, it happened in a fraction of a second in the infinitesimal pause between Dumbledore said three, Harry looked up at him, they were very close together, and Dumbledore's clear blue gaze moved from the port key to Harry's face.
So he actually frickin' looked at him.
And what happened when he looked at him?
Harry's scar burned white hot. So are those two things related? I don't know.
His scar burned white hot as though an old wound had burst open, and unbidden, unwanted, but terrifyingly strong, there rose within Harry a hatred so powerful he felt that for that instant that he would like nothing better than to strike, to bite, to sink his fangs into the man before him.
This is really stressing me out, not knowing what the hell's going on with this, because it's like, I know you know, and I know people listening to this know. It's fine.
Do you have any theories?
No, I don't. Other than there's a connection to Voldemort, or, you know, some sort of darkness that Dumbledore and Harry have kind of connected together. But I just feel like, I don't know.
Yep. And then poof, in a swirl of colors, they arrive back in Grimmauld Place. And of course, the picture of Walburga Black is screaming, like, back again, the blood traitor brats. Is it true their father's dying?
Oh my god, this bitch, right? She's a pill.
Yep. And then we've got Sirius, which... Sirius was hurrying towards them, looking all anxious. He was unshaven and still in his day clothes, and there was also a slightly Mundungus-like whiff of stale drink about him. So yeah, I've always kind of interpreted this that, you know, Sirius is becoming an alcoholic being cooped up in here.
He's a bit sassy, too. Like, not sassy, but just maybe lacking some empathy, you know,
Later on. So eventually Harry, you know, tells the story again for Ginny, Fred, and George, but does it in a way that he's a third-party bystander, mm-hmm. You know, like with his dream with Frank Bryce, rather than being the snake itself.
Right.
And so they're like, let's go to St. Mungo's. And Sirius is like, no, you cannot show up there, you know, when the doctors haven't even told his wife.
Right. And be like, fishy.
And it's like, you know, of course we can go to St. Mungo's. You know, what does that matter? It matters because we don't want to draw attention to the fact that Harry is having visions of things that are happening hundreds of miles away. You know, listen, your dad's been hurt while on duty for the Order, and the circumstances are fishy enough without his children knowing about it seconds after it happened. You could seriously damage the Orders. We don't care about the dumb Order. It's our dad dying we're talking about. Your father knew what he was getting into, and he won't thank you for messing things up for the Order. This is how it is. This is why you're not in the Order. You don't understand. There are things worth dying for. Easy for you to say. Stuck here, Bellofred. I don't see you risking your neck. Like, the worst possible thing to say to Sirius right now.
Yikes. This is getting ugly, but as things do when the emotions are high.
Yeah, the little color remaining in Sirius's face drained from it. He looked for a moment as though he would quite like to hit Fred. Yeah, but when he spoke, it was in a voice of determined calm. I know it's hard, but we've all got to act as though we don't know anything yet.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, he's being smart. I think there's the emotional reaction of like, let's just go, and because our dad is dying, and, you know, but probably shouldn't run off there.
Yep. And so literally they just, you know, sit up drinking the butter beer, and they get a note from Mrs. Weasley from Fox. And it's like, you know, dad is still alive. I'm setting out for St. Mungo's. Stay where you are.
Yeah.
And it's like, still alive, but that makes it sound, it sounded to Harry, too, as though Mr. Weasley was hovering somewhere between life and death.
Hey, sounds like it was. Like, I don't know what to tell him.
Did you think that Arthur was going to die?
No. And the reason is, because I was like, there is definitely, had I not existed in the world and known anything about these books until, like, you know, I started reading it, he's too big of a character to die and me not know about it. So, like, I mean, there's one character I didn't know about and I'm still sad that I knew. But I was like, okay, he's going to be fine. He's not the one that's going to die quite yet. I know who the Weasley that dies is. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yep. And so finally, you know, after excruciating waiting, Mrs. Weasley comes in and it's like, he's going to be all right. He's sleeping. We can all go see him later. Bill's sitting with him now. He's going to take the morning off work.
Yeah.
And you just said that. And it's like Fred fell back into his chair with his hands over his face. Oh, now I got all sad. Why did you do that to me? I wasn't thinking about that death yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know it's coming. I don't know. I forget. I think it's in this book. I'm not sure. But I know it's coming.
Mm-hmm. So we've got, so finally, you know, they have some breakfast. And Harry's like, Sirius, I need to talk to you like now.
Yeah.
And Harry's trying to explain, you know, I saw it from the snake's perspective. And did you tell Dumbledore this? And I'm like, yeah. And it's like, it's more than that. Like, I just in his office, I wanted to bite him. I wanted to attack him. It must have been the aftermath of the vision. That's all, said Sirius. You were still thinking of the dream or whatever it was. And, you know, this is Sirius being unusually evasive.
Yes.
Because he's very... he's usually the one that advocates for Harry to know shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he kind of dismisses it. He's like, yeah, just stop worrying. Let's
and make go to some bed. Bacon.
Right, yeah. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm. He clapped Harry on the shoulder and left him in the pantry, leaving Harry standing alone in the dark, which, yeah, that's like...
Yeah. Something's going on. I don't know about it yet.
Okay, and this is why, like... Again, shit like this happened. This is why it was stupid not to tell Harry anything, because he's going to find out shit anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because there's no way to avoid this.
No, he'll figure it out.
Yep. And so everyone but Harry spent the rest of the morning sleeping. By the time Ron wakes up, Harry pretended to have enjoyed a refreshing nap too. And then joining them to escort them across London is Tonks and Mad-Eye.
Yeah, and back again with her pink hair.
Pink hair and a bowler hat to cover Mad-Eye's crazy eye.
Crazy eye. That's all right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And even Tonks is asking, like, there isn't any seer blood in your family, is there?
So I thought about that, too, before she asked it. And I was like, he says no, like, very quickly no. How does he know that, though?
He doesn't.
Okay. All right. That's what I thought. I was like, he didn't do like 23andMe. Like, I don't know what the wizard version of that is. So I'm like, let's just...
when finances are not as tight, I do want to go do the 23andMe because I'm curious to see, you know, exactly how Danish I am because, you know, both my great grandparents were from Denmark. So if they were full blooded, then I would be 25% Danish, but again, who knows what their mixture was, even though they were in Denmark, who knows what their mixture was of European stuff.
Yeah, man, I don't know.
Anyway, so, you know, they go out into Muggle London and he's like, where is the hospital? And it's like, not far. Wasn't easy to find a good location for a hospital. Nowhere in Diagon Alley was big enough, and we couldn't have it underground like the ministry, unhealthy. Which just made me really sad, because it just makes me think of, like, the maternity wards in Kiev forced underground because of all the bombings in Ukraine right now.
Yeah, that is very upsetting.
And then people are just hiding out in, like, the metro stations underground.
Yep. I have a coworker who's a friend's, like, something son or something is doing exactly that. It's pretty terrifying.
Yeah. Like, literally just hiding out in the metro?
In the metro, yeah.
In Kiev, or?
I don't remember where exactly it was, but she was talking about it, and she's talking about him, like, running across the street to go get food and seeing, you know, dead people in the street. It's very
people
very
dying, being shot at just in line to get bread. It's like,
yeah,
but they're like taking out a lot of the Russian generals, and it's like,
oh really? I
like they're like, you know, again, Putin's now in a pickle where it's well, he's already in a pickle, but he's in a pickle now where the only way to take Ukraine is to be truly, you know, to be a monster and, you know, chemical weapons, just slaughter them, you know, and that's going to kill him politically. And yeah, like there's damned if you do, damned if you don't, which he didn't need to do this to himself, but he's insane.
Yeah. 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 It's a very, sometimes I have to, I glance at headlines and sometimes I get too emotionally invested in those things. So I have to shut it off, which I know is not the best thing to do, but I got to live in this world too.
Yeah. So anyway, so I was just thinking that just, you know, didn't want the hospital to be underground unhealthy. That just triggered me, all the shit.
Yeah.
Everyone hiding out underground.
Yeah. It's very sad.
Yeah. So, but they finally get there, and so it appears that the hospital is hidden in this old dilapidated department store.
Another, this stressed me out. I just gotta say. Freaking the dummy, like, that gives a nod. Like, oh my god, that is so
scary.
That
is ultimate horror film.
It could be, I'm sure it exists. It's a like, little creepy.
What is it? The Wax Museum franchise?
Oh, House of Wax.
House of Wax, yeah.
Yeah, that I've seen that movie. It's gross. Yeah, and
never upsetting. Saw it yet.
Don't.
Yep. And so, you know, they step inside and none of the dummy muggles can see that they're just disappearing into the glass.
Yeah, this is interesting. Interesting the way these things work sometimes. But this is a very bustling hospital, as I guess a muggle hospital would be.
Mm-hmm. And so Harry's just, you know, taking in the scene, and he sees that there are wizards with lime green robes, and their robes are embossed with like an X, like a cross with a wand and a bone. And he's like, are they doctors? And it's like, doctors, said Ron, looking startled. Those muggle nutters that cut people up? Nah, they're healers. Which just goes to show you, yeah, it is pretty morbid that doctors just cut people up.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was an interesting quote from Ron, because it's like, yeah, it's kind of what they do. That's kind of sad. But
yep, and it's just lovely. We get this, was it over here? And they followed her to the queue in front of a plump blonde witch seated at the desk marked inquiries. They were behind her. He was covered in notices and posters saying things like, clean cauldron keeps potions from becoming poisons, and antidotes are antidotes unless they're approved by a qualified healer. And just all these little, like, you know, brochures and pamphlets that, you know, when you're like in a doctor's office.
Right. Yeah. I liked that. It was pretty cute. I like the clean cauldron keeps potions from becoming poisons. I was like, all right. They're just encouraging good, you know, cleaning habits, I guess. Yeah.
Yep. And so then we've got Dillis Derwhite, you know, St. Mungo's healer, headmistress of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry in the 18th century. So it looks like, and she winks at Harry. So clearly she was also in Dumbledore's office.
Yeah.
So just think about it. Dumbledore has access to all of these institutions, the hospital, the Ministry of Magic, probably other places, maybe Gringotts. He has access to all these places via the previous headmaster's portraits.
I'm just thinking about him and his power as a headmaster. So interesting.
Yep. So yeah, we've got, you know, I'm just gonna read this for shits and giggles, you know, just ground floor artifact accidents, cauldron explosions, wand backfiring, broom crashes, first floor creature induced injuries, second floor magical bugs, contagious maladies, dragon pox, vanishing sickness, scrofungalus, third floor potions and plant poisoning, rashes, regurgitation, uncontrollable giggling, etc. Fourth floor spell damage, unliftable jinxes, hexes, and incorrectly applied charms. Fifth floor, visitors' tea room and hospital. If you are unsure where to go, incapable of normal speech, or unable to remember why you are here, our welcome witch will be pleased to help.
That's very clever. The list of floors and, yeah, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And which the welcome witch is not all that. She doesn't have any, I don't know what the word, bedside manners or, you know, definitely no, should not be the receptionist.
No, she's taking care of business. She's like, next. She's like a, you know, she just wants to get these people out of her way.
Which, I don't know. It's, you know, there's one, like, cashier at this convenience store near where I work where, I only go into town, like, you know, twice a week, you know, to be on campus. And so, like, I go there to get my chocolate milk because that's my coffee.
That's all right. That's good.
And the guy just has no, like, he's just like, he just does it, and like, you know, he does he doesn't do the typical why expect, like, hello, you know, have a good day, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's just so, like, you know, like this lady.
He's like, he's just not, he's just put out just by being there, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Man.
Yep. And so they go into, you know, first floor, second door on the right, Dia, Lou, and Ward. And that is where Arthur is being kept because the first floor is, you know, creature-induced injuries.
Yeah. He's not alone.
He's not alone. He's also there with someone who's been bitten by a werewolf.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also with a woman who won't say what bit her, which makes everyone think she was handling something illegally.
Yeah. They said that, like, when they go to dress the wounds, it's, like, smells really bad, too.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds nasty.
And, you know, despite being in the throes of death, you know, Mr. Weasley is just all hunky-dory.
Yeah, he's, like, chilling. He's just, like, reading the Daily Prophet. He's whatever.
Yeah, and it's, like, he's got his bandages, and it's, like, you know, if it wasn't for these bandages, I would just go home. It's, like, why can't you take them off? And it's, like, because I start bleeding like mad whenever they do.
What in the world is it's horrible. I mean, and all from this snake bite, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, well, first Mad-Eye and Tonks, you know, they stepped aside. And so now it's just the family and Harry, you know, visiting. And Fred and George are just like, what were you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, is it going to be in the Prophet that you've been attacked? And it's like, no, of course not. The Ministry of Magic wouldn't want everyone to know a dirty great serpent got Arthur, got me.
That was weird.
Yep. And also Fred and George are like, you were guarding it, weren't you? Harry, didn't you say you know who's got a snake? A massive one. You saw it the night he returned, didn't you?
Oh, gosh. We're going way back to that.
Yeah. So I don't think I'm giving anything away. Obviously, that snake was Nagini.
Yeah. Yeah, that's who I thought it was, too. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, so, because there are really no others. It would be awesome if there were others, but yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I was talking to Nat, and apparently she's death. I didn't realize how deathly afraid she was of snakes.
Really?
And I'm just like, so what do you do with the, like, Nagini chapters? Then she's just like, nope. you and spiders.
Yes, I was going to say, I can relate. The S critters are just...
Like, again, for you, it's spiders. For her, it's snakes. For my husband, it's alligators and crocodiles. Like,
oh, wow.
I cannot honestly say that there is a particular animal that I absolutely abhor and, like, cannot stand or am deathly afraid of or think is gross. It's
probably because you're, like, you see the world a little differently as a pagan, I guess. All everybody's purpose, maybe?
Maybe. If there's anything, like... Again, I'm not the biggest fan of scorpions, which is something I've had deal with, of course, in the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, and in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But even though I'm a Scorpio ascendant, but.
Well, like crabs are like sea. I don't know. No, it's a lobster. It's like a sea spider. Anyway.
Like literally, I'm legit trying to think. Is there anything that completely grosses me out? And if anything, like a squid, like particularly like some of those like giant ass squids in you know, in the deep dark sea, like that would, if I was confronted with one of those, I'd be like mortified.
Yeah, that's pretty terrifying. Oh gosh.
Well, not throwing any shade at the giant squid in the Black Lake because he's a kindly cephalopod.
Yes, that's what you told me. I was a little creeped out by him, but or her, I don't know the gender.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress. And finally, you know, they usher the kids away and Tonks and Mad-Eye go to talk to Arthur. And Fred and George are like, let's see if they've put an imperturbable charm on the ward doors, shall we? And they haven't, and so they can hear every word.
Yeah, bad news for Harry with this.
Yeah, so they are all now huddling at the door, listening in, And Tonks is like, they searched the whole area, but they couldn't find the snake anywhere. It just seems to have vanished after it had attacked you, Arthur. But you know who can't have expected a snake to get in, can he? I reckon he sent it as a lookout, growled Moody, because he's not had any luck so far, has he? No, I reckon he's trying to get a clearer picture of what he's facing. And if Arthur hadn't been there, the beast would have had much more time to look around. So Potter says he saw it all happen. Yes, said Mrs. Weasley. You know, Dumbledore seems almost to have been waiting for Harry to see something like this. Yeah, well, there's something funny about the Potter kid. We all know that. Dumbledore seemed worried about Harry when I spoke to him this morning. Of course he's worried. The boy seeing things from inside you-know-who's snake. Obviously, Potter doesn't realize what that means, but if you know who's possessing him.
Yeah.
Harry pulled the extendable ear out of his own, his heart hammering very fast and heat rushing up to his face. He looked around at the others. They were all staring at him, their strings still trailing from their ears, looking suddenly fearful.
What a way to end that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's why they have to end like that.
I know.
So, lots going on. What did you, how you feel about that throwing demonic possession or whatever?
Yeah, I don't really know what to think about that because we always knew that there's a connection between, you know, Voldemort and Harry, or, you know, something, the scar and all of that. But actual possession, I don't know. I'm not so sure about this. So interested to see how everything transpires.
Yeah. Alrighty then, shall we get into Gothic Geek Out?
Yes. Well, it's really, I think I had my first thought and then I had what I channeled Amy for my second one, but I'm just going to go with my first one, which is the Thestrals, the spooky horses. Cause they do have a very kind of spooky, again, my favorite Gothic monster vibe to them. So, and especially with the little added, you know, special sauce of the only people that can see them is somebody who's experienced like seen death. So it's pretty goth if you ask me.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like they don't, you know, obviously because of the death thing, you know, they get this bad rep and superstition attached to them. But in essence, they're like, even though they're carnivorous, they're a very docile, you know, in demeanor, they're very much like herd animals, like deer or horses.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not necessarily, like, they're not vicious. They're pretty chill. I'm trying to think of, I don't know what to compare it to, but that was mine.
Mine was Nagini the snake.
Okay. All right.
And I'm basically pulling up an article from our old friend, the Gothic librarian.
Oh yeah.
She came and visited us a few times in Sublimely Gothic podcast when we did Rebecca and there was something else. And Castle of Otranto, I think.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So literally, I was like, snakes in Gothic literature, and her article was the first one that came up.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah. So, snakes in Gothic literature. As reminders of our baser animal nature and the wild power of the natural world, animals frequently play an important role in Gothic literature. I've previously written posts on the roles of cats and dogs. Now I want to focus on one animal that has been particularly feared throughout history, snakes. Associated with deception, temptation, and sin, snakes make powerful symbols of abstract evil, in addition to the connotations they already hold as genuine objects of fear in the real world. Below are a few classic works that derive their horror from deadly snakes or serpents. The Anaconda by Matthew Lewis, 1808. Matthew Lewis was the same guy who wrote The Monk, his magnum opus.
Yeah.
In this short story, Matthew Lewis uses the same level of gory, shocking violence that he was notorious for in The Monk, only this time the bloodshed is committed not by a man, but by a snake. Everard Brooke has recently returned to England from the East Indies and suddenly in possession of a great fortune. When his lover's family demands he account for how he came by the money, Everard tells a frightening tale about a monstrous anaconda that lived in the forest of Ceylon, Sri Lanka, devouring men and beasts alike. Its multicolored scales can deflect bullets, and its mere breath is poisonous. In a particularly gruesome scene, the snake kills a beloved pet dog by crushing every bone in its body. With the help of one of the locals, Everard engages in a valiant fight against the monstrous snake to rescue his friend trapped in an outbuilding. But though the snake is ultimately killed, the story does not quite have a happy ending. As a work of colonial Gothic, the serpent in the anaconda embodies the wild unknown dangers that lurk in the strange and foreign lands.
Wow. Well, I don't think I'm going to be reading the Matthew Lewis story anytime soon.
Yeah. And then also The Adventures of the Speckled Band by Arthur Conan Doyle, 1892.
Okay.
This is one of the 12 tales featured in Arthur Doyle's collection, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and Doyle himself considered it his favorite story he'd written about the detective.
Okay.
By including it here, I'm giving away a bit of the solution to the story's central mystery. So again, spoilers, everyone, for Sherlock Holmes fans. I never was a fan. So
yeah, I like the show, but that's kind of
So you don't mind spoilers, I assume.
No.
So at the start of the story, a young woman named Helen comes to Sherlock concerned that her stepfather has murdered her sister and now plans to kill her next, though she cannot figure out how. The tale is the classic example of a locked room mystery, and among the more puzzling clues are the sister's dying words, the speckled band. Through a series of clever deductions, Sherlock discovers how the stepfather accomplished the murder of Helen's sister. He dropped a venomous snake through the vent in her ceiling. Go ahead.
Oh, it just reminds me of a show my husband and I watch where they a guy throws a snake at somebody to kill him, like a rattlesnake. So
yeah. As in Lewis' story above, the snake is a product of British colonialism. The stepfather had developed a passion for exotic animals after living abroad in India, and the snake is one of the many dangerous creatures he collected in his home. Sherlock identifies it as a swamp adder, the deadliest snake in India. While many critics consider the snake specific here to be a fictitious creation, Sherlock fans have debated for many decades which real-life species Doyle may have been referring to.
Huh.
That reminds me of J.R.R. Tolkien. His inspiration for the giant spider Shelob came from some like terrifying huge spiders that when he was a child in Africa.
Yeah, I don't need to know any more about that. That sounds awful. Yeah. Oh my God.
And then the last one that the Gothic Librarian mentions is The Lair of the White Worm by Bram Stoker, which I have read this and I hated it so much.
Good to know.
I hated it. It was considered his last novel. It is so fucking racist that no amount of historical like context can forgive it.
He was kind of racist, Doyle was.
Yeah, so anyway. So in Sturker's Notum, you know, he comes into the great uncle's estate in Derbyshire, and when he arrives, discovers that Lady Arabella March, a local witch-like woman, has been murdering people by tossing them into a pit where they are eventually devoured by the white worm. Though called a worm, the creature is not a little wriggling invertebrate, but rather a giant serpentine monster with glowing green eyes that is suggested to be a holdover from times when dragons roamed the earth. The mystical connection between the white worm and Lady Arabella is reminiscent of legendary snake women such as Lamia in Greek mythology. When the snake in this tale appears to originate in England, unlike the two above, there are still strong currents of xenophobia and British imperialistic thought throughout the book. That's an understatement.
Yeah. Oh, I think I'll pass on that one. I almost read some big thing about Arthur Conan Doyle just because everybody knows how much I love Dracula, and I was just like, it's all right. So
yeah, well, I guess it's just interesting, again, specifically with, you know, a lot of Gothic literature, you know, there's obviously other types of, you know, Canadian Gothic, American Gothic, but with like original British Gothic, the idea of the snake being brought in, not only because of its you know, very old connotations like biblical and, you know, temptation and all that crap, but the fact that it was having at that point a very recent connotation of like the exotic and xenophobic stuff by representing fear and unknown of India. And the East as savage and monstrous.
Yeah. I remember studying that when I did the Gothic lit class and whenever two of them or whatever.
Maybe that's what I should write my article on for the Gothic Studies Journal.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
Anyway, so I went on a tangent longer than I typically do for Gothic Geek Out, but I was very interested in, like, you know, there's more to, like, the snake in Gothic literature. Even in Mexican Gothic, it's the symbol of the snake eating its tail, so the continuity of life, you know, creation and destruction and all that crap.
what is that called? It's like, it starts with an I, doesn't it?
I can't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty heavy symbol in that, Mexican Gothic. Well, snakes, I thought you were going to say portraits. So,
although that is, I didn't even think of that, but you're right. Yeah. Cause you know, I feel like Harry Potter is the first modern series, at least very well known in pop culture, to take such a kind of obscure gothic trope from like old school Castle of Otranto and completely, you know, rely so heavily on it for like, again, these sort of central plot points.
True. Very true.
Anyway, so that's that. And now we move on to Tarot of the Day. Which the card that I picked at random was the Eight of Pentacles.
All right.
So let's see what we got. The Eight of Pentacles is a card of apprenticeship and mastery. When this card appears in a tarot reading, you are working hard to improve your skills and become a master at what you do. You may have recently changed your work, education, or financial circumstances, and now you are applying your sheer determination and concentration to master the new skill that you are learning. You are diligent and hardworking, and you are applying yourself fully to whatever is at the center of your attention. As you do the same task over and over, you work your way towards a mastery of your craft, and through your perseverance and unwavering attention, you create success.
The first thing that comes to mind for me is the Dumbledore's Army little classes and kind of everybody's success when they're working on that in this chapter too, and kind of the conclusion of that for at least for a little while everybody goes on Christmas break.
Yes, this is true, of course. You know, yeah, very much Eight of Pentacles. It's not just general, like, working hard. It is specifically in the connotation of, like, the apprentice and the master. Like, you know, you're learning under someone specific. And I sort of thought of Hermione in her determination. She's like, I will plan Hagrid's, you know, lessons if I have to. You know, and literally trying so hard to like school Hagrid and being like, you know, this Umbridge woman is a legitimate like political threat. You cannot fuck around with her. And
right.
Yep. Cool. What else do we got? More broadly, the Eight of Pentacles suggests you are working away at the finer details of the various aspects of your life in an effort to continuously improve your situation. You may be unhappy with your current state, and you know you need to make some important changes in your life to increase overall satisfaction. Which, this card is a positive sign that you are committed to making those changes and to ensuring that you give yourself the best possible chance. Overall, this is very hardworking and conscientious energy that is present in your life. Oh, Cupcake is moaning again.
Uh-uh. I didn't hear her that time.
She's so precious. So, I kind of think of, you know, Harry reaching a new like not dating but clearly crossing a certain threat precipice with his relationship with Cho.
Yeah, that just made me think of when you're talking about apprentice mastery with or earlier I was thinking of Hermione like schooling Ron and Harry, but anyway, sorry.
Yeah, which they would fail without her.
They really would. Yeah.
Yep. And then, so the card I pulled for the Black Moon Astrology cards is another one of the house cards.
Okay.
Specifically, the fifth house.
Don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Which general word associated creativity.
Oh, okay.
If the zodiac has a fun house, it would be the fifth house. Pleasure, creativity, and children are all elements of this house. Being in ingenious and in the limelight is another element. We find our childlike imaginations through storytelling and fantasy. Playing is very much what the fifth house is all about. That's why this part of the chart also rules over romance, especially beginning stages.
Cho and Harry.
Yeah, so just the very budding romance.
Yes.
Of two young teenagers.
Oh, love.
As children, our imaginations know no bounds and we indulge in creative performances. So that kind of makes me think of, you know, Harry's very, you know, juvenile, like, you know, fantasies of thinking of Cho, seeing him as such a like heroic badass.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny.
Like in the way that he was going to accidentally show her his hand all cut up.
Oh, yeah. God. I forgot about that. That's pretty silly.
Yeah, this card turning up in a reading indicates that you have created or will begin to create something to be proud of, something that will bring others joy. It may have you on a stage or just in an area where adults can let down their hair and become, as children, responsive, joyful, and free.
Responsive. I just don't feel that when you're ending these two chapters on kind of the injury of Arthur Weasley and kind of the reveal of the connection between Harry and Voldemort, it's kind of hard to think like light and airy and fifth house, you know, mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah. Since the fifth house is the natural house position for the sign Leo, someone close to you, a potential lover, a mate, or two of you together will make a striking appearance. It's time to go out and be seen. This card may turn up during the time of a budding romance. Perhaps your current relationship will go through a positive transformation, or perhaps there is a new potential mate on the scene. So, the most we can glean out of this is, you know, with things of creativity and pleasure, that just makes me think of the sacral chakra.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, childlike imaginations through storytelling and fantasy, which the beginning of his dream is very much childlike and just normal shit.
It is, with the kind of random, you know, the fireball and the chocolate frogs and all kind of all over the place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, yeah, that's all I've got. That's all I can say. Yeah. Anything else?
It's hard to kind of take that house and apply it. But then I guess, too, we could say a little bit of the hints of Ron and Hermione's eventual relationship, too.
Oh, this is true. And yeah, because the sense of, I don't know, I guess in budding romance, you know, we don't know. We never see the contents of Hermione's, you know, letters to Crumb. Like, what is it? Is it smut?
Yeah, hey, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway. Alrighty then. Good stuff. Good stuff. And now we move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time.
Okay. I'm just going to go and I'm not going to put any context around it. What if Harry didn't have the vision of Arthur?
If Harry did not have the vision, well, again, we don't know from what Mrs. Weasley seemed to say to Harry and thanking him. Like, if not for you, they probably wouldn't have found him for hours. Right. So, like, there might have been the chance that maybe someone, like, changing guard duty would have found him. But even so, probably that would have been too late.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I just think we might have lost Arthur Weasley if that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, like there's very strong chance that he would have died. And again, this makes me think of certain elements in the phases of the pandemic where certain hotspots were so overwhelmed that there was a guy who had a medical emergency that was not COVID related. And one of the doctors, you know, needed to fly him to like a specialty hospital. And like what you would usually get this sort of logistics handled in 20 minutes and have the guy helicoptered out, like had to wait 9 hours because everywhere was full because of COVID and the guy ended up dying. Yeah. And the doctor took it really, really hard and is just like, this is the 21st century. Like this was something that was so easily treatable. It just needed to be dealt with in a timely fashion. And no one could.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awful.
And also it just brings up the sense of, you know, obviously, you know, wizards are mortal. And I guess there's this balance of like, yeah, like they can heal a lot more things than we can. But also and I guess there's a balance of like, yeah, like if, you know, something like this, if you leak it long enough, of course he's going to die. You know, if you know, someone intervenes magically. But also there's the sense of like how much, again, we think of all the bodily harm with the kids at Hogwarts, thinking like how much can a wizarding body withstand? And, you know, I sort of infer that, you know, the magical nature of Arthur Weasley being a wizard and having that sort of stamina and endurance, combined with the fact that this was a very magically venomous snake, that basically him being bit is the same as us being bit by a normal venomous snake. And the time frame that he would need treatment would be basically the same.
Yeah.
if it was like a quote unquote normal venomous snake, like, I don't know, what's the most venomous snake in Australia? I can't even remember, like, the test fin. I can't even remember the name. Like, if that had bitten him, he probably could have held out longer as a wizard, but this was a magical snake, so yeah, it's different.
Yeah. Well, that was mine. I didn't think there was a lot of room for, well, I didn't have a lot of good speculation this week.
Yeah, mine, obviously, that's, you know, what if Arthur had died?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, what would the implications of that be, you know, both for the order and for the family? How would Harry would feel, of course, so guilty?
You know, that's a good question. And that's something that I thought of when we were reading this, because as far as we know, nobody has informed Percy, right? He's still kind of absent.
Yeah.
He's not there. I know they're estranged, but I feel like when something that major happens, somebody should at least like send an owl and let him know. So I wonder how that's all going to transpire.
Yep. And then one thing I had is, what if Nagini had been captured?
And like, she didn't bite Arthur?
No, she bit Arthur.
Oh.
People came running and they were actually able to trap her so that she couldn't escape.
That's an interesting question, because I don't know. I don't fully understand her connection to Voldemort like yet. So
yeah. So at this point, all we know that she's basically his bitch.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of slither around, does what he wants. Again, Voldemort relied on her a lot when he didn't have his body.
Right.
So, yeah. So I'm just thinking, like, what would the order do with that if they were able to, like, you know, basically hold the snake hostage, and like, how would Voldemort react to that? Like, you know, could they glean any information out of her?
Because she's an animagus or animagus.
She's a maledictus.
Maledictus.
So again, that's the whole with the Fantastic Beast thing. That was never in the original books.
Okay.
Because basically, you know, she was human once, but a maledictus is someone that for a while they seem like a normal animagus that they can transform at will, but it is going to get to a point where, you know, a maledictus, you know, stays in their animal state forever.
Okay.
So it's inferred, you know, by this new crap that's showing up in the Fantastic Beasts franchise is that by the Harry Potter books, like, Nagini has made that transformation and she's just always a snake now. Like, she's never a human.
Okay, cool.
How she got from point A to point B is still a major, like, we don't know how the hell that's going to happen.
Maybe we'll find out. I don't know.
Yeah, because Secrets of Dumbledore is coming out soon.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just thinking, like, literally have this, like, snake in a tank in Grimmauld Place.
That sounds terrifying, because she's not small.
Yeah, because she's not small, and trying to think, like, what to do with it, and, like, whether you can get anything out of it. And again, if, you know, who is, like, possessing Nagini to, like, see things, would he be able to see things through Nagini's eyes?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was just my thought.
Yeah, I don't know. As this gets more complicated, and I don't know.
Yep. Alrighty then, and thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Puffs. Tune in next time, and we'll cover chapters 23 and 24, Christmas on the Closed Ward, and Occlumency. And joining us will be my one and only sister, Holly.
Yay, Holly!
Yes. Catch you guys later. Bye! Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophia Mayer Studios podcast.